This interview with Greg Carpenter was recorded on March 20th, 2021, during the Baltimore Youth Film Arts Workshop, Inside Stories, Perspectives on Incarceration.
So, Mr. Gregory, you have been in the jail for 20 years. In what time of the period did you change your life value? How long did it take for you to change your life value? And do you think, being in the jail for 3 years and 20 years have that much of a difference?
Well, okay, I'll say it like this. For some people, all it takes is a night. And for others, it might take a lifetime, and it still never happens. For me, I think that I may have been in my fourth or fifth year. Maybe my third year is when the lights came on for me. But, you know, that was like for my life values that have been instilled in me as a young person growing up. You know, because we all kind of get values, mores, you know, from, you know, our parents or whoever it is we trust and, you know, believe and look up to. And so I had a solid foundation as a little person, and it eventually met me again as an adult. And so probably 3 years or so into my incarceration, I realized that what I was doing to myself was not healthy, and it wouldn't have a good outcome if I continued on, and I needed to do better for me and for nobody else. And then, like I had mentioned too in the past when we talked initially about my tragic situation of losing my mother while in prison and not being able to go to be a part of that event or that service or process. And I said, you know, to myself, just, hey, I got to do better. I want to make my mother proud. Even though, you know, she won't see me, but, you know, I got, you know, so a couple little things. So the other part of it, so major events, or life-altering events and situations give you cause or reason to reevaluate, and it puts you on a different kind of trajectory in life. And so you draw on a lot of those things, again, that you had been taught. So about 3 years in, I guess, is really when came to understand and need to make the adjustment in my life.
Thank you very much, Mr. Query. That was an excellent answer. I have one more question that follows up. So you said it took your 3 years to realize what you have done. Then what did the other 17-ish year, what were you thought changing during the other 17 years?
Well, one, you know, I had to submit myself to the force, and I'm Muslim, of course, so I had to submit my will that of the Creator. And so I went about making me better. I changed habits. I changed, you know, some instances, people that I, you know, kind of associated myself with. And it was kind of hard, you know, for some of the associations because, for example, I'll just go straight in. So I used to drink a lot of weed and drank a lot of wine in prison, right? And we used to make the wine or whatever. Anyway, so when I, you know, decided to make this adjustment, my close buddy, he didn't want to believe it. So he was, you know, at me every day. Come on, let's, you know, I'm not doing that no more. And so people who are close to you and they see you change, they don't want to accept that for a lot of reasons. And then once they finally accept it, then it's okay. Then they know that okay, so I know we're doing something different now. But I went back to school. I did more reading. And, you know, I did more introspective and just, like I say, evaluating myself, evaluating what meant something to me or what I thought had value for me really didn't have as much value. So I changed my lifestyle and I started to do more positive things. I started to be optimistic. I was never really a pessimistic person, but I became more optimistic about life and about outcomes. Because throughout my sojourn in prison, even though I had what could just possibly be considered a death sentence, basically, because, you know, you go to prison, one, and you don't know the outcome. But I've seen individuals come in with misdemeanor charges and end up with a life sentence because they had to do something along the way that altered their whole situation. And so you make these adjustments and you do, you know, what you kind of have to do to make it happen. So, again, I was just, you know, going to school and, you know, just doing these positive things and knowing that eventually I was going to get out. Knowing that no matter what anybody said, I wasn't going to spend my life in prison. But if I had to, I was going to be the best that I could be. And so, you know, we started to do different things, work with different groups of individuals, and just stuff, you know, to try to make your, because one thing about forgiveness, once you forgive and once you let go, then the process becomes easy, right?
And, would that be especially so forgiving yourself? Greg, would that especially be forgiving yourself?
Yeah, forgiving yourself, you know, exactly, because you know you've harmed people, and whether or not people forgive you, long as you've forgiven yourself and you've made a vow or a commitment to do best and do better for yourself, that's it. Because one thing that we have learned over the years is that the only thing that you got any kind of control over is your own actions. That's it. And so you can't begin to hope and think, well, not going to say hope, you can't begin to think that people are just going to accept you because you say you changed. Okay, how do I know that? I don't, you know. So the thing is that, okay, you changed, big deal. You know, good for you. But the harm that you brought in my life, you know, still exists, or it still has memories of being there, and I have to reflect on it every day. And again, you know, it's two ways to look at it. You can look at it in the negative or you look at it in the positive. Because we've learned that, you know, everything has good in it. Everything. I don't care what situation it is, how gloom and doom it may seem, but in that is some good, you know? That's just part of, you know, how we kind of look at it. So, but again, I always knew I was going to come home. At least that was my thinking and my feeling. And I knew a lot of guys who felt the same way, but never made it home, you know?
Do you think your change in value affect others?
I think my value?
Yeah. Do you think, like, how you have changed and grown to another person have affecting the people around you, like you have said earlier?
Yes. Yes, I think. I've had situations where, you know, I've been in individuals' presence of life for, you know, periods of time. And I want to share this one with you because this is so kind of just poignant for me in a lot of ways. But it's a dear friend of mine, a situation. We were in Hagerstown. And we used to have conversations every day. And so if you had a Christian background, I had a Christian background, but I'd made a transition and I became Muslim. Anyway, so every day we would have these conversations. And so eventually I left him in Hagerstown and I came down to MCIJ. And then I eventually came home. And then I was getting, you know, questions from people who say, you know, Charlie Dean, you know, his brother named Byron Lucas was his name. And I said, yeah. And then he was telling me about, you know, how he had, you know, transitioned over into Islam and how his life, you know, anyway, long story short is that we saw each other on the street and so forth and so on. Then one day, I got a phone call from him. He said, man, we need to have a talk. Say, I need to see you because this is serious. He said, I'm dying. And I want to make sure I get a proper burial. But yeah, so he called me and he told me he was dying, you know, and he had this rare form of cancer, but he wanted to make sure that, you know, that he got in the ground properly. And so this was no light request, because when in Islam, the way we bury our dead, we just wash the body, shroud it, and bury it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in our society, in America, we are so accustomed to embalming and that sort of thing. Right? And so, you know, we had conversations with his parents and so forth and his family. And we visited, me and my partner, Mikhail, we visited him on a regular basis. So we kind of was there, you know, by his bedside all along as he continued slowly to deteriorate.
Yes.
But I was just pointing that one out because of the question. And how do you think you impact others' lives with your change and how you start to live your life? And that was just one example, but it was a very powerful example. Because he wanted me to be a part of his last rites, because that's the last thing we can do for somebody is put him in the ground.
Greg, you really feel emotional because you say you really contributed something to him in his last moments. So is that why you feel so emotional right now? Because you were
not only that, just the fact that where we started out in our journey and how we started out in our journey and how we ended up, because you got to remember, I'm not the only person that this young man knew. You know, he had family members and he had tons of people that he knew. But to me, it's obvious, or it became obvious, that our relationship was far deeper than I had any idea it was. Because, like I said, over the years, and then we kind of separated in terms of our space and where we were together and so forth and so on. And then even like I said, after he came home, he went on with his life and I did the same thing. But it come back at this moment, like you said, in his last hours, you know, he thought enough of me to reach out to me. Not anybody else. He reached out to me, you know. And so that's what was going on with me, right? The fact that we made such an indelible impression over the years through our mannerisms, and it's all about, you know, the change that had taken place. You know, that he saw some good qualities, and you know, he figured he would be okay. You know,
he saw you change, and in turn, that like led him closer to you, is what you're saying.
Well, yeah, he really didn't see me change. He saw the change. Because when I met him, I had already, but I guess I was still a work in progress and I act like I am now, but he didn't know me before. So what he saw was the change that had taken place and that was taking place. Maybe 7, 8, 9, 10 years in the making.
Okay.
Yeah, so we were, I was further along in my journey and my change when I met him.
Mm-hmm.
But the relationship that we developed over the years that we've been together, I think we're together about 2 years maybe. Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
That impacted his life.
Anybody else? Questions for Greg?
Thank you, sir. That was a powerful story.
Mm-hmm.
Good questions, Ian. Mm-hmm. Michelle, what about you today? What you got going? How's your mind thinking?
So I had a question about like your experience when you were incarcerated. Mm-hmm. Could you just talk about like how your routine was like when you first got in and like the transition, like your daily routine as it went over the years.
Right. So for me, like I said, when I came into the prison system, I was still smoking weed, and because you couldn't tell me that it was nobody on the face of the earth that didn't smoke marijuana at the time. I said, no way in the world, not the way this stuff make you feel. Everybody do this. I know. But I eventually found out that I was wrong, right, in my thinking. My process was kind of faulty. But, you know, we made the wine. Because the thing about coming in prison, and if you're still kind of wild and just rambunctious, I was a youngster. So, you know, I wanted to still enjoy myself. And if you can make wine, because back in the day, in the Maryland Penitentiary, you could make wine as long as you didn't make a whole lot of it. You could make you a gallon of wine, and it was basically legal to do. You could have your gallon of wine, so we used to make the wine. But I used to make it for sale. So I'd make 5 or 6 gallons at the time, you know, so we'd be selling about a quart, you know. So that was my whole kind of daily routine, finding the wine, finding the weed, and, you know, just doing dumb stuff, you know, just wasting time. And so, you know, I worked in food service, so I had some access to different stuff. Because I've always worked around food if I worked in prison. But, you know, later on, when I made my adjustments, then, you know, I really got more into exercising. I always played ball, so I was always a baller, you know. But I started doing more exercise, and I started doing more reading. And so, you know, that changed for me. So then again, because I was doing these things, I was, you know, in an environment now with individuals who were more attuned to trying to, you know, do the right things. And like I say, there's a group inside, you know, that is the moral compass for the system, if you will. So they try to keep the guys on right, and they try to keep the staff on right, so that nobody is really violated to such a degree that, you know, it's just not right. And so, you know, I started to hang out with more of these kinds of guys, you know, and because the thing about prison, you read and read and read, you really become intellectual. Because all you got is time, and if you're taking advantage of your time, then you're going to be smart, and you're going to have answers, whether they're the right answers or the wrong answers, you're going to have answers. So, you know, for me, you know, my day, you know, started to center around, you know, being more positive and doing responsible things. And as I continued to do that, more responsibility came to me. Because at one point, you know, I became what we call in Islam, imam, or the leader, the spiritual leader of the community. At one point, I became president of the Inmate Advisory Council. So you can see how starting out as just a straight knucklehead turned into an individual or someone who became more responsible and people looked up to and people trusted and people, you know, entrusted their, you know, affairs, you know. And you know, going to school and just, you know, doing those kinds of things and just trying to, you know, make the environment inside better by, you know, introducing different opportunities and different ideas to the administration. Because, see, for the administration, their whole goal is security. So however many layers of defense they can have between you and the outside, it's better for them. It's harder for, you know, you think about escaping and that sort of thing, right? And so we would come up with stuff like, for example, you know, we came up with the idea of making sure that they had movies, you know, DVDs and stuff like that. And so now you don't have to go to a location in the jail to watch a movie. You can watch a movie right in the dorm or right in the cell block, you see. So, I mean, but not that we were trying to make it better for the administration. We were trying to make it better for, you know, the residents, because we are already getting the short end of the stick. So whatever we could do, you know, to make life a lot easier. Even I remember when we was at MCIJ, before I left, we were able to secure what is now, well, I don't know if they're still doing it, but Family Day. It would be a whole weekend where you would invite your family and they would come in and you would, you know, just you have a good time. And so it became so popular, you couldn't do everybody. So they had to take days where, you know, this group go this day, this group go this day, this group. So but anyway, we were just, you know, so that's kind of how, you know, things changed for me. And that's how, you know, my days were spent, you know, just, you know, being productive. So now it didn't seem like I was in prison because I was doing meaningful stuff and being responsible as an individual who was responsible on the street and so forth. And you have a lot of individuals that, you know, that do that. That's why when, you know, you start to ask, man, how did you do that much time, you know, for the person who's conscious or at least, you know, have a goal in mind, it's easy because now you're not concerned about where you are. You're more concerned about, can I accomplish my task today that I set out to do?